A better way to go than the V-22? I'm Paul Plack, and this is Aero News. Welcome into this Aero News special feature. I'm Paul Plack in Mentone, Indiana, where the PRA, Popular Rotorcraft Association, last week held its 2007 National Convention and Fly-In. And we're here with Jay Carter, who is the president and CEO of Carter Aviation Technologies. Many of our listeners know the Carter Copter, which made a lot of headlines, and it was a very striking-looking craft. It was a composite, egg-shaped rotorcraft with sweeping tail booms. It was an autogyro. It used a modified Chevrolet engine for a power plant. It had a lot of other unusual features, especially the rotor. We're here to talk now about the formation of Carter Aviation Technologies growing out of a presentation done at NASA. Jay, thanks again for joining us today. Let me ask you how you made the transition, very briefly, from that meeting at NASA to the foundation of Carter Aviation Technologies. Did that move quickly, or was that a laborious labor?
No, actually, that moved pretty quickly. It's interesting that when the government gets interested and really gets interested in something, things can move along fairly fast. So we ended up applying for a SBIR Phase 1. We got that. Even before we got that, I think people knew that we were probably going to get that. I was invited to be a part of a, can't remember exactly what the name of it was, but it was the future, 10 years in advance, you know, what the future of aviation was going to be like. And it was interesting that they invited me to be there, and I had a model of the aircraft there. And Dan Golden, who was the director of NASA at that time, actually attended, got really interested in what, you know, I had to say and about the aircraft and everything. And so really, as a result of that, that phase one, there was some magazine articles that came out about what we were doing, and some of them were very controversial. As a matter of fact, Machine Design ran an article about what we were doing, and they did it basically because we had gotten this phase one, and that added a lot of credibility to what we were doing. Well, anyway, they ran this story about what we were building and what the future was and what the potential and everything was. And they later came back and said it was about the most controversial article that they had run in a long time, because everybody was writing in to the magazine saying, how could you be taken in by this flim-flam guy? Everybody knows that adding a rotor to a wing is just going to increase drag, not decrease drag. And I used to have so much respect for your magazine now, and I probably will never look at your magazine again. And so they went on, you know, they said it was a very controversial. So that what they did is they came back and did a really detailed story, mm-hmm. and allowed me to go into detail as to how we did this and why it worked and everything. Mm-hmm. So basically to kind of cover their rear end, you know, mm-hmm. for having stuck their neck out, you know. But then they mentioned that, you know, we got a phase one. There were a lot of technical gurus that thought this was a pretty good deal.
Well, you know, I have to say that in all fairness, if you were to look back in history at all the flim-flam schemes over time, a lot of them involve flying machines that look too good to be true. So I think it's kind of a natural reaction for the world to have.
I would agree with that. You know, I would agree with that. Here we were. The other thing that made this unbelievable was that we were just a real small company. I mean, this is the kind of thing that you would expect to come from a major aerospace company, and certainly one that had been in rotorcraft. Here is an upstart company that nobody ever heard about. He's talking about an aircraft that will take off and land vertically, fly coast to coast at 400 miles an hour, carrying five people. I mean, that sounds pretty ridiculous, you know, for some, you know. And so, first blush, if I were somebody else and I was another engineer and I'd heard that, I would have thought, yeah, the same thing, you know. But that was what was really nice about the Machine Design coming back and now going into a much more detailed mm-hmm. and going with me, so that now I could sit down and explain how we went about doing this. Well, of course, now then there was people saying, okay, you know, that sounds kind of reasonable what he's talking about, you know. But still, this is 400 miles an hour coast to coast from a little bitty company. So anyway, that kind of started things, and of course, as a result of that, we started getting investors that were just coming to me and saying, I want to invest in your company. Here's some money. And so I thought, well, that's not a bad deal. You know, that I don't have to put my money in it anymore, because that's what I was doing, was putting my money in. And we had a lot of people that were kind of working on a sweat equity. And so, you know, having some money kind of helped speed things up and certainly took the pressure off of me. And my wife, you know, she wasn't too excited about us spending a lot of our retirement on you know, something that looked good, but, you know, still she's more reasonable. Maybe not reasonable, but, you know, she's a little bit more conservative than I am. She doesn't understand, but she has a lot of confidence in me. But she still knows, you know, bad things can happen, you know. And so that worked out pretty good. And so for the first number of years, it was good. I had investors coming to me, and I could just flat say, I got as much money as I want. I don't want to sell any more stock. Mm-hmm. And of course, it meant that every time I sold stock thereafter, because we would meet milestones, not necessarily having the plane flying, but we would meet more milestones that we said we were going to do. And so then I was able to sell the stock for more money the next time. And so I just basically was able to sell stock as we went along to support this, to the point that today the stock sells for about 25 times more than what it did when we first started. But that's because we've broken Mu-1. We're the first aircraft to do that. And we did that under an Army contract where the Army came in and said, look, we... been hearing a lot of good things, and you know, but we just are still a little skeptical, and we would like to be a part of the data collection system, you know, and be a part and be able to see this all for ourselves. And so,
not that we don't trust you, but we want to have our recording machines on your machine.
Right. So they wanted to be a part of getting the data and everything, and so that was just fine with me. And they supplied us with a lot of instrumentation and stuff that we were able to put on the aircraft. That I couldn't afford. You know, I just flat couldn't afford some of this instrumentation and all that they put on. And so under that contract, we did. We slowed the rotor down and achieved this Mu-1. And the Mu-1, the significance of Mu-1 is not just that we achieved a Mu-1. It's that by slowing the rotor down, the efficiency of this aircraft just went up exponentially. And in the process, we got almost twice as good of efficiency as the very best helicopter had ever achieved at 170 miles an hour. And they had a 50-plus year head start on us. And this was our first prototype from a little bitty small company. So that's pretty significant when you do that.
Now, you say from a little bitty small company, but tell me in your experience, looking back now, is there not a sort of inertia that develops for old ideas, especially in big companies that have government contracts over time?
That is true. They are very slow, very resistant to change. There's a lot of inertia and everything in there. There was an article that was written by us from Flight Journal, and it was written by Barnaby Wainfelt, who is an advanced concept design engineer for Northrop Grumman. And he did a really nice article about us. And in there, he went through and explained why we were successful and the major aerospace companies were not successful. You know, back in the late 50s, early 60s, both the U.S. government and the British government both made a really focused effort to try to develop an aircraft that's called a slowed rotor compound. And because everybody knew that if you could slow the rotor down, wonderful things would happen, but most people thought it was impossible to do. So both the U.S. government and the British government made a real focused effort to try to see if those problems could be resolved. The U.S. version was the McDonnell XV-1. The British version was the Ferry Rotodyne. Mm-hmm. And I tell you, for first prototypes, I thought they both did a fantastic job. Both of those aircraft achieved almost 200 miles an hour. The Ferry Rotodyne set a world speed record at that time for rotary wing aircraft, and it was a 40-passenger aircraft. Mm-hmm. But they did have some problems. They had some problems. They didn't understand how to control the flapping. They did not understand how to control the rotor RPM. There were a number of things that they didn't really understand how to do. And there were some problems even flying that fast. So what ended up happening was the technical community said, I just don't think these problems are solvable. I just don't think it's reasonable. You know, maybe you might be able to do something, but it's not going to be practical. And so that really killed research and development for helicopters, because they had concluded that if you're going to take off and land vertically and fly real fast, The only way to do that is with the tilt rotor. And so that is when the funding began for the tilt rotor. And that is why there has been so much money spent on the tilt rotor, because the need for an aircraft that can take off and land vertically and fly real fast and efficient like a fixed-wing airplane or near that of a fixed-wing airplane is great. And, of course, our military really wants that kind of an aircraft. So that is the reason why that even though the Osprey, the B-22 tilt rotor, had a number of accidents where a number of Marines got killed, that's why it didn't die. Because the military is saying, okay, we made some mistakes, but we got to have this aircraft. It is crucial, and it will save, in the end, many more lives than the fact that we've lost some people. So that's the rationale, and that was the rationale why they spent over $30 billion developing this tilt rotor. I mean, I like to sometimes put this in perspective to people. A full nuclear-powered aircraft carrier without any of the airplanes, but everything else is about $3 billion. So $30 billion is 10 times that just to develop this technology. So I believe that back in the, when they were working on the XV-1 and the Ferry Rotodyne, that there were some sharp engineers that were saying, I think I know how to solve those problems. The problem is they never got a chance because big government or businesses and stuff like that, they can't accept mistakes very often. You know, if it doesn't work the first time or whatever, they don't have, a lot of times the decision makers are not engineers. They're businessmen. And they end up saying, I just don't think you're going to be able to do this. And they don't give them enough of a chance. And so I think that's what happened, is they just gave up too soon. Well, of course, that just opened up the opportunity for us to come in. And I was naive enough, you know, that I didn't know how difficult it was going to be. In reality, I didn't know how difficult it was going to be. Well, the actual aerodynamics and everything actually were right on. Did not have a problem there. Where I had the problem was this was my basic first aircraft, and I made a lot of fundamental mistakes that an aerospace company wouldn't have made. But at the same time, I knew what I was doing. I mean, from an aerodynamic standpoint, I knew this had the potential, and I knew that the problems that we were having had absolutely nothing to do with with slowing the rotor down and achieving this mu. It was developing a prop, developing the engine, you know, the problems we had with turbocharging the engine, developing the controls, just stuff that a normal aerospace company might not have had, those kind of problems. But we had the advantage, we had the tenacity to keep on. And when we had a problem, it was not a deal breaker. Mm-hmm. You know, it was, okay, we just learned something, we'll correct that, and we'll go on. And eventually we did, and we were successful.
Let me stop here for our break, but when we come back, I want to talk about, I think our listeners can go to the website and read the detailed press releases over time and look at specifically what the Carter copter accomplished. You have a device here at Mentone, a little machine based on the butterfly gyroplane that is called a technology demonstrator. I want to talk to you a little bit about where Carter is going from here and where that machine fits in. My guest is Jay Carter Jr., who is president and CEO of Carter Aviation Technologies. I'm Paul Plack, and you're listening to a special feature from Aero News.
Shoot happens. Come on, you know it does. Even the world's top test pilots know there are in-flight situations you can't always recover from. Mid-air collision, control failure, pilot incapacitation. In severe emergencies, do what the world's top test pilots do. Use a parachute. Except, instead of having to bail out of a moving aircraft, you can have the safety of a BRS full airframe recovery parachute. BRS has parachutes for an enormous variety of aircraft, from experimental to light sport, and all the way to retrofits on certified airplanes. Shoot happens. Will you be ready when it does? Call BRS today at 651-457-8651 or visit us online at brsparachutes.com. Higher, faster, farther, safer. Those are the watchwords of Columbia Aircraft Manufacturing's new generation of personal airplanes. The Columbia 350 and 400 are now available with either an Abadine or Garmin electronic cockpit. The new Garmin G1000 equipped Columbia 350 and 400 have just been introduced with the new ReadyPad. While the G1000 panel integrates all navigation and flight instruments into two high-resolution screens, incorporating GPS, nav, comm, autopilot, transponder, and flight director into one easy-to-use package. To schedule a demo flight in a Columbia 350 or the turbocharged 400, call 541-318-1144 or check them out on the web at flycolumbia.com.
Welcome back to Mentone, Indiana, where the PRA had its National Flying In Convention last week. I'm Paul Plack. We're talking today with Jay Carter Jr. of Carter Aviation Technology. And Jay, we talked about the process of working through the technical difficulties to demonstrate what the Carter copter was able to achieve. Let's talk about where the company is going now, because you have said all along that you are a technology development company, not a manufacturing company, and it looks like you may be facing a change in that that outlook.
That is correct. You know, my goal was, of course, to develop the technology and license that technology to other companies so they could take advantage of that and manufacture. But that doesn't seem to be working. Nobody's really come to us and saying, hey, we'd like your technology. I don't know whether it's not invented here. Everybody has the pride of ownership of what they've been doing themselves. But nobody has really come to us. And yet we've done some things that I think are pretty unique and nobody's ever done before.
And there's been all that Army instrumentation on board to prove you did them.
That's right. There's no way around that. Yeah. In fact, it really surprised me about the Army until I finally got into this a little bit more and come to find out, you know, our technology is a disruptive technology. It's not a complement necessarily to what's already out there. It's a disruptive technology. And so there are a lot of generals that have got their whole career behind a certain program that they've got going. And this would kill that program, and it would kill their chances of going to work for a Boeing or a Lockheed, because that's who they would like to go to work for once they retire.
Well, and you talk about having $30 billion in the development of the V-22. How are those folks going to feel when a little upstart company for a tiny fraction of that amount develops what amounts to a replacement for that technology?
Again, it's the same thing. You know, you've just got careers and tremendous amount of money that's been invested in the status quo, but in the development of something else. And so we are a disruptive technology, and it's really hard for them to pick that up. So anyway, I'm finding out how very, very difficult it is to sell our technology within the military. There's a lot of people within the military that are very interested in this. And so as a result of that, we've given briefings to four-star generals, to three-star admirals, to lots of colonels and generals. And in fact, is in the last 12 months, I've given over 45 briefings, different areas. And so there is a lot of interest. But for some reason or another, as soon as it goes up to the next level, to the general level or whatever, it gets killed. It for some reason or another, it's just not right. It's, you know, it's, gee whiz, it is frustrating. But we will eventually prevail, because it is the best thing out there. And I don't feel like I'm just kidding myself. It's just, we've done some things. It's going to change transportation. But right now, it is a disruptive technology. The major aerospace companies are fighting this. They do not want a change. They've got a really good business going right now. It's very lucrative. They're making a ton of money. They don't need a disruptive technology coming along. So, you know, they throw red flags up and say, oh, well, they're just a small company and they don't have the capability to do this and they may go out of business and whatever kind of, you know, what they can come up with, you know, to throw water. Well, these military decision makers are saying, you know, if this doesn't work out, I'm going to be blamed. You know, if I go with a small company like Carter, even though it's a small company and it doesn't cost very much, if it doesn't work out, it's going to be my career. Now, if I go with a Boeing or a Bell or a Sikorsky or something, and it may cost 10 times, 20 times more, $50 million or $100 million, if it's a failure, it's not going to be a reflection on me. It's going to be Boeing or Lockheed's problem.
Right. Well, let me ask you the obvious devil's advocate question then. What if you go to countries elsewhere in the world who might snap this right up and obviously would have the wherewithal to fund the conclusion of the development?
We're really reluctant to do that. I mean, I have a lot of pride in our country and a lot of... So that is not going to happen unless it gets to the point where I have no other choice. And I think I've got choices that will keep me from having to do that. But it has been a real struggle, and it's been, you know, and even our Congress, same problem. You know, I go to them, and they say, yeah, this sounds kind of interesting, but, you know, if this was really that good, why wouldn't the military be interested in this? You know, and until the military shows some interest, I'm not sure that I'm really ready to stick my neck out. You're just a small company. I mean, this is what they're probably thinking to themselves. You're just a small company. You don't have that many employees. You're not going to really help me get reelected. You don't have any funds to help my reelection campaign, you know, and it just, so we don't get any congressional support either. So in the end, it looks like we got to do it on our own. I mean, it just, it's sad, but it doesn't look like there's that interest out there to help support us. Luckily, we have some really good investors, and we have some people that are seeing the potential and everything. So anyway, what we're working on now is a four-place, which we call our personal air vehicle. And this is our second-generation aircraft. We retired the five-place that broke this Mu-1 and got this great efficiency. We retired that in 2005, and the reason we retired it is shortly after we achieved this Mu-1, we had a problem in flight where the pulley, we had just got through replacing the belt on the drive pulley, and I think, I can't prove it, but I think we didn't properly torque up the bolts to that because it broke. Those bolts broke, and I think they just vibrated loose, and when they vibrate loose, then it puts a big moment on it, and it breaks the bolts. Because we'd run this thing for years, really, literally, and put 600 horsepower on it and never had a problem. But we did have that problem. The engine was fine. Everything was fine. We just lost power to the prop, and we were in a position where we had no place to land but some mesquite trees. And so we came in and had to make a landing in the mesquite trees. Well, our landing gear saved our butts, you know, the pilot's butts. Nobody got hurt. The fuselage was basically intact. The prop, because it was just freewheeling, even though it hit a tree, it came to an abrupt stop, and you could see that it was really smacked. But it looked pretty good. But the trees did a number on the wings, the rotor blade, the tail boom. You know, you just meet an immovable object, and even though you're only going maybe not very fast forward, yeah, it still tears things up. And the rotor blade, of course, was still turning fast, so when it hit the trees, why, it jerked that off. And so anyway, we were faced with a decision then: do we repair, which we could have, or do we take what we've learned and build a new design four place, what we call personal air vehicle? And so that's what we decided to do, and that's what we're doing right now. And we're pretty far along on that. Not as far as I'd like to have been. And part of this is because of the military. We ended up getting a group of retired military that are gung-ho military. And they want what's best for our troops over there. They want what will save lives, and they want those troops to have the most efficient way to fight. And so they work for the Boeings and the Lockheeds and the Northrop Grummans and stuff like that, and they make a good living at that. Mm-hmm. But they came to find out about us and came down and visited us, and boy, all of a sudden, you know, they're saying, this is what our military needs. We really need this. This will help our people. And so they took this on their own, and it's a company called AgileCast. Mark Gay is the president of that. He's a retired Army colonel. And so they took this on with the idea that, hey, what you need, Jay, is you need somebody out there that knows the military, knows how to promote this, knows how to sell this within the military, and we think we are the right ones. And I agree, they've done a fantastic job. But, of course, like I said, they run into this same problem. We get people really excited, really motivated about this. But then when it comes to finally doing the deal or something and it goes up the ladder, some general, you know, vetoes it. And who knows for real what reason. I got my own reasons around it. But, you know, I can't prove it. And, of course, they would deny it from now on. But anyway, they have been working this for a long time. And, of course, we keep thinking that we're going to get funding right around the block. You know, we're going to get funding. Well, of course, if you think you're going to get funding, it's hard for me then to justify going out and selling more stock in the company. Because I don't want to sell stock in the company if I don't have to. And so that's kind of slowed things up. Plus, in visiting all these colonels and all these people, you know, you get a real good understanding of what it is they really need. And so I went back and I changed the design so that I could really meet their needs. Well, changing the design meant changing the rotor blade. It meant changing the gearbox. It meant changing the rotor head. It means increasing the structure. It meant changing the engine. It was a lot of stuff that we ended up changing because we understood this really would be better for the military. And if we're about to get funding from the military, let's go ahead and make those changes. So we made those changes on our nickel. Of course, that really slowed down the process of getting this four-place built. So in the end, that may have been a mistake on my part because I bought into that. And I could see the enthusiasm of some of the military people that we were talking to because they're starting to see the great potential. And some of them are questioning about, Jay, how come we haven't ever heard about this before? The Army did all this test. They have all the data. They know that you did this. This is wonderful stuff. How come, you know, well, I think the Army just set on it because it was... did not support programs of record, programs that they were already working on. It did not support the fact that a whole bunch of people in the Army said, this is BS. You're never going to be able to do this. You know, they were very negative about what we were doing.
There was lots of egg on face at high places.
I'm sure there probably were. And of course, that was probably wanting to be toned down so that nobody really heard about it, because the less people know about it, the less egg there is on their face. So anyway, in the end, we will prevail, because the aircraft is heads and shoulders above. It gives us the capability, our military, both not only just our military, but even our commercial. It gives us the ability to take off and land vertically and fly as fast and as efficient as a fixed-wing airplane. Now, we're not going to compete in efficiency with jets. But they take 5,000-6,000 feet to get off the runway. But for general aviation or turboprops, we're going to be able to be very competitive on an efficiency.
And if you're looking at where general aviation seems to be going, which is fractionals and air taxis and all this point-to-point and NASA's own small aircraft transportation system initiative, this seems to fit right in.
Not only does it fit right in, to me it even complements this, because they're talking about still using existing small airports, trying to get closer and closer to point to point. But they still can't do point to point because they can't take off and land vertically.
Right.
We can take off and land vertically, and we can do it so much simpler than a helicopter. Now, we don't have hover capabilities. There is a way that we can have full hover capabilities, but when we do that, we end up with about the same complexity, the same risks, the same training required of the pilots as of a helicopter. So, yeah, for those applications where you have to hover, we can do that also. But there's another alternative, and that is the slowed rotor compound gyro, you know, that just uses high inertia in the rotor blade. We spin the rotor up. That's how we attain these vertical takeoff and landing. It is so much simpler and so much less costly and safer that for most of the applications, that's the way to go.
We're about out of time here, but if I understand correctly where you're going with this, it sounds like you're going to have to fund it with investment and prove it in the commercial and private sector before the military is really going to bite.
I think that's right. I think what we'll have to do is we'll have to get this four-place aircraft flying, and it's going to have phenomenal capabilities. Like, I mean, we can carry four people and fly from L.A. to New York City. I mean, that's pretty outstanding for an aircraft that'll take off vertically and do that. And yet, that's the kind of capability that we have in this four-place. So our vision is that we will build some of these aircraft, and then we'll start taking them on a worldwide tour, and we'll take the editor of the Wall Street Journal and the Business Week and Newsweek and Fortune 500 and, any editor that will want to go fly in this aircraft. We may do rally or raffles or something so that one of them can fly with us when we fly from Hawaii to L.A. or from L.A. to New York or from New York to Paris or something. I mean, you know, so that they have the opportunity to fly with us when we do this. And because of all of the avionics and the electronics and the computers of today and what we're doing over there in the war effort where we have unmanned aerial vehicles, this aircraft, this four-place that we're building, we're going to incorporate a lot of that in here. So that this aircraft is really going to be, you tell it where you want to fly, and this aircraft will take off. It will fly you to your destination and land without you ever touching the stick. Now, that doesn't mean you can't override it at any point, but still, it is getting to the point where you can make this thing the Jetsons. I mean, you know, to the point where this thing will fly to your destination. If you pass out, fall asleep, or have a heart attack.
Or in a military application get shot.
Or in a military application get shot, then this aircraft has the capability of bringing you home and landing you safely. And if there is no airport or no place within gliding distance, if you lose an engine, it's going to find a flat piece of land, and it's going to bring you down into the wind, making a perfect landing. If it ends up being in the trees, you're going to tear the aircraft up, but you're going to walk away from it. Or, you know, you're not going to get injured as a result.
Or when they find you, they'll be able to carry you away.
That's right. That's right. So that's what it is. So I think this has just got so much going for it that I can't stop being so enthusiastic. I mean, it gets me up in the morning at 4 o'clock, and I'm ready to go to work. And it's contagious. And we're getting a lot of other good people that come on board, and it's a hell of a lot of fun when you get a lot of smart people all pulling together to make something happen. It is a blast. It really is.
Well, Jay, it obviously, you don't have to fake your enthusiasm here. We really appreciate your taking this much time out to talk to us about it, but this sounds like one of these watershed moments in aviation if you can make this happen, and we wish you the best.
Well, thank you. We hope it happens, because if we do, then we did do something worthwhile. And that's really what motivates most of us, is to do something really worthwhile. Not just make money, but do something really worthwhile.
You've been listening to a special feature from Aero News. On the web, you'll find us at aero-news.net. I'm Paul Plack. Thanks for listening. Have a clear and unlimited day.